From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with sportscaster Tim McCarver. His baseball insights, drawn from his 21 years as a major league catcher, have won praise from TV critics and from fans. Also, I'll talk with playwright John Guare. His award-winning play, The House of Blue Leaves, is coming to public television. Ken Tucker reviews movies just released on home video, and singer Ian Whitcomb takes us on a trip through Tin Pan Alley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air is Tim McCarver, the play-by-play announcer for the New York Mets and ABC's Monday Night Baseball. McCarver is a former catcher who began his major league career in 1959. By the time of his retirement in 1980, he was the only catcher in history whose career extended into four decades. He describes the position as the most demanding, underestimated job in sports. McCarver caught for some of the best pitchers of his time, including Cardinals Hall of Famer Bob Gibson and Phillies Cy Young winner Steve Carlton. During the many years that Carlton shunned the press, it fell to McCarver to provide the post-game analysis of the pitcher's performance. In his current sportscasting work, McCarver has been praised by media critics for avoiding the old tired clichés. Instead, he provides a more thoughtful, analytical game call. McCarver has just written a baseball memoir. It's titled Baby, I Love It. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry. Nice being with you.
Are there any permanent changes in your anatomy from having crouched and caught for so many years?
I don't know whether there are permanent changes in my anatomy. I know that I can tell when it's raining outside without opening the shutters. I know when it's snowing and what the temperature is going to be like before I go outside. From catching, I have arthritis and in the knees. Even though I never had a major or serious knee injury, I was never cut on. The only time I was on the disabled list, as a matter of fact, was back in 1970 when Willie Mays fouled a ball back into my right hand and broke it, and I was out for 4 months. And I'm kind of proud. I think more proud of that fact than I am of anything in my career because of my durability. I'm glad I was durable.
Can I see your hands?
Sure.
They look, can you
normal,
turn them over? Let me
huh?
see the palms of your hands. They look normal. I wasn't, after having the ball pound against your hand for so many years, I thought they might be more gnarled.
The particular mitts that I used, I think, aided and abetting a longer living left hand, because the pitchers that you catch throw awfully hard, and when you catch the ball away from the bone right below your index finger, it takes some of the cushion. It kind of cushions the blow and takes some of the sting and bite away. My left thumb is in pretty bad shape and hyperextended. But I feel fortunate in that I was able to play 21 years and 21 years in the big leagues for the most part without having a serious injury.
What is so grueling about catching?
Squatting, the foul tips, the mental strain as much as anything. I mean, the feeling that you have to concern yourself with other people. A shortstop really has to worry about catching the ball and throwing the ball. He has some, he's got to make some moves with his second baseman, that a little rhythm and timing moves. Outfielders have to work with guys, but a catcher really has to work with his pitcher. And when you work that closely with somebody, you can't help but feel for him when he gets tagged with a loss. If you lose a game 3-2 and you called a pitch that you know shouldn't have been thrown later on, then the pitcher may accept it and say, don't worry about it, we'll get him next time, but you know fully well that it was a bad call, then you stay awake at night as much as he does. And you're staying awake every night for every pitcher that you catch, you see, because you're going to be back behind the plate again. The mental strain can be as difficult as the physical strain, and there's a lot of physical strain. Ball's bouncing up. A baseball's hard. And it's thrown awfully hard. It's thrown 90-plus miles an hour. and it's spinning and twisting and everything. And a catcher in the big leagues cannot catch a full season or 130 to 140 games without half of the time going behind the plate and being hurt and feeling pain.
When you say that the position is underestimated, do you mean by the fans, by the players, or by the people in the front office?
Yes. All of the above. The fans, because they can only vicariously see what's going on, and the front office, because they often negotiate contracts, like the catcher was supposed to hit driving 100 runs. I mean, when Johnny Bench drove in, he won two MVPs, driving in over 100 runs, I believe, four times in his career. A remarkable achievement. Gary Carter, three or four times 100 RBIs. Remarkable achievements, because to go back there day in and day out and then still be able to contribute offensively is just truly remarkable.
Why is it so unlikely that a catcher would be a great batter?
Well, primarily because of the fatigue. If I had a nickel for every third and fourth at bat of a game where I made an out, most of the time lazy fly balls the other way, it beats your arms down. The balls beat your arms down. The strain of your emphasis is on something else. It's not necessarily on only your offense. It's on other things. It's helping your pitcher. It's manipulating a game. It's matching wits. It's there are just so many things that are involved in that particular position other than the physical strain. I think the standards offensively for catchers going into the Hall of Fame should be lowered, as a matter of fact. I used to negotiate contracts back in the middle 60s, and the general managers used to tell me that my numbers were not as good as an outfielder's or an infielder's or a first baseman's. And I said, but I'm a catcher. They never understood it, or at least they used that to negotiate.
From your catcher's perspective, who should the strategist be, the catcher or the pitcher?
Well, the pitcher's the guy who has to throw the ball, and so he is the guy who ultimately throws the pitch. A catcher will suggest very strongly that a pitch should be called, and if the pitcher still disagrees, then it's time to talk, and then only should you go out to the mound. I hate conferences at the mound. I think they don't serve any purpose, and a lot of the times on television, a lot of the announcers will talk about how what's being said on the mound, and most of the time it's for show and not very thought provoking things.
What does it show? What's
well,
the show about?
Well, it shows that a catcher is going out there to slow down his pitcher, to speed him up, or talk about things. And catchers seem to make their living doing this. I remember Johnny Keene, when I was catching for the Cardinals back in 1963, used to ask me to go out to slow down Bob Gibson. And I used to say, John, he doesn't want me to be out there slowing him down. He wants to work at his pace. And so John wanted me to go out there. Gibson wanted me away from there. I remember one time I went out to the mound and Bob told me to go on back behind the plate. The only thing I knew about pitching was that it was hard to hit.
Well, do some pitchers resent it if the catcher tries to tell them what kind of pitch to throw? Do they feel like they're handing over their game to the catcher?
Oh, yes. And I don't think any catcher worth his salt really tries to enforce a particular type of game from a pitcher. I think a lot of catchers with experience will try to railroad a young pitcher into pitching the catcher's type of game instead of the pitcher's. And I think the pitchers, or the catchers worth their salt, will work with the pitcher and not try to strong-arm him.
What about the batter? The batter comes up to hit. You're catching right next to him. Is there tension between the two of you frequently? Would you try to psych each other out or knock off each other's equilibrium?
No. A lot of catchers are often asked if they talk to the hitters. I never felt that it was professionally responsible to talk to hitters in particular situations like that. If you couldn't get them out the way the rules of the game were played, I thought it was a minor league attitude for a catcher to take, and totally unprofessional to spend most of that time trying to distract the hitter by talking to him.
The pitchers who you work with the longest were Bob Gibson and Steve Carlton. Mm-hmm. Did you have to act almost like a psychologist to both of those pitchers, just to psych out what they were doing in their game and to help them get more on track if they were losing it?
I think psychologist is probably too strong a word, because guys who are intelligent like Carlton and Gibson, and I caught some pitchers who weren't intelligent, and I'm not trying to say that I am, but Bob Gibson and Steve Carlton were the two types of individuals who would read through things like that. I mean, the one thing that I tried to do more than anything else is to be honest. I would try. A catcher is an expert on results of pitches. He's not an expert on how to throw a pitch, but he is on the result of a particular pitch. And I tried to put that more to use than anything else, the results of the pitches that not only Carlton and Gibson threw, but anybody that I caught.
What were some of the things that you would tell Carlton or Gibson if they were in a slump? What could you tell them?
I tried to stay away from things like that. Catchers are often put into awkward positions as far as arm movement and arm location. I didn't tell them too many things at all about getting – you got to pitch your way out of it. You pitch your way into things like that, to little ruts, and you're a human being, and you're going to fall into little ruts like that occasionally. But guys like Carlton and Gibson, they didn't fall into them too frequently.
You had caught for Carlton in the Cardinals,
mm-hmm.
and then when
mm-hmm.
he moved to the Phillies, they basically sent for you after a while, right?
Well, they sent for me via several other ball clubs. I played with two teams twice. I played for the Cardinals on two different during two different tenures, and then with the Phillies in two different tenures. And I was released from the Boston Red Sox back in 1975, and I came to Philadelphia, as a matter of fact, to interview and to audition for two television stations. And the present owner of the Phillies, who was then the business manager, Bill Giles, called and asked me if I wanted to continue my career, and I did. I was only 33 years old, and they were having roster problems, and Carlton was having personal problems as far as personal professional problems, and so they thought with the addition of me that it could get a team that was relatively successful before back together again, and that proved to be a good move on their part.
Did you feel like you were able to help straighten out some of the problems Carlton was having?
The one thing I did was call for a slider. There was a difference of opinion in the organization at the time that Steve Carlton's best pitch was his fastball. Well, I knew at the time that his best pitch was his slider because I'd been on the other side hitting against Carlton's slider for two or three years. So and plus I'd caught him, so I'd seen him from both ends.
Are the balls that are the hardest to hit at bat also the balls that are hard to catch if
yes,
you're a
catcher?
Yes,
that's a good question, and that's true. Generally speaking, the balls that are toughest to hit are the toughest to catch, and because Bob Gibson was difficult to hit, it made him difficult to catch. Conversely, however, Carlton was easy to catch. You could catch him in a rocking chair. His slider in the dirt was tough, but it was a gaugeable ball that you knew how to block it. You knew the spin and the rotation and where to go when the ball went in the dirt, and most of the time it was not a problem. But his fastball was, you could catch him in your living room.
Are there some fastballs that are so fast that you can't really see them that well?
No. I mean, after all, a catcher has the advantage of knowing what's coming. And consequently, because he knows what's coming, major league pitchers can put the ball in an area about the width of two balls or so, which is about a 6-inch area. And they can do that with a great deal of frequency. And because of that skill, the act of catching the ball is an easy thing to do. However, squatting and getting down in that position, there's no telling how many times I did that. And I'm proud of the fact that I was able to do it. I was gifted with strong legs, and that's why I was able to do that.
Did you spend time with your pitcher outside of the game?
Oh, yes. Bill Dickey, back in 1959, I signed out of high school. And Bill Dickey, I almost signed with the Yankees. And Bill Dickey, of course, a Hall of Fame catcher for the Yankees. And he handed me a list of what catchers should do. And I remember one of those things on that list was to be a pitcher's friend. And that never left me. And I mean all of the qualifications that friendship implies, not necessarily telling him everything is fine and everything's, going to be all right and all that sort of stuff, and not necessarily stroking him, but telling him the truth, getting angry when he deserves it, and really having, I think that's what communication is really all about, not to tell the pitcher what he wants to hear, but to tell him the truth, and that's what I tried to do.
I want to ask you one more thing about catching. Would you ever want to catch again? If you were given the option of putting on all the equipment again and catching for a game, how would you feel about getting back into that position, getting back into the crouch, putting on the gear?
I think knowing what I do know now about how tough a position it is, I don't know whether I would have started catching. However, looking back on it with such satisfaction, I'm glad I did it, because the satisfaction that you got out of it, or that I got out of it, was just enormous. I mean, a catcher can go 0-for-4 in a ball game, and if the team wins, he gets an amazing amount of satisfaction, even not doing well offensively.
My guest is sportscaster and former catcher Tim McCarver. He's written a baseball memoir titled Oh Baby, I Love It. We'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Tim McCarver, you've been broadcasting since 1980. Was catching good preparation for the kind of sportscasting you're doing now? Was it a good position to play for sportscasting?
It's the best preparation. A lot of people don't realize that catchers in the broadcasting booth are virtually doing or facing the field, even though they're two or three stories higher. They're facing the field from the same position and viewing the game from the same position that they worked at it for such a long period of time in most cases. A lot of the things that you think about or that you thought about as a catcher, you have a chance to bring out into the open as a broadcaster. For instance, if a right-handed hitter is hitting and a pitcher is working the right-handed hitter to the outside part of the plate, making it more difficult to pull a pitch, and the outfield is playing the particular hitter around to pull, and you fully are aware that the hitter is more inclined to hit the ball the other way. These are some of the things that you thought about as a catcher, and you can relay and share with the audience some of those thoughts. It's such a complex position to play. Another example, if the infield is shifted around and the pitcher is throwing a steady diet of breaking balls away to the hitter, well, then you should be able to talk about this and tell the audience why the pitcher may be thinking, or why he's wrong in going against the way his defense is. Now, if you were a shortstop to become a broadcaster, it would be difficult to do this because he doesn't have the same panoramic view that a catcher has.
You certainly had a chance to listen to and watch plenty of ball games before becoming a sportscaster yourself.
Yeah.
Were there any cliches you swore you wouldn't say when you got started in the broadcasting business?
I didn't use a lot of cliches as a player in interviews, and of course being interviewed is different than interviewing someone else. But I've always sworn off cliches, really. I know in spring training it used to be, for the sake of just having something to say, baseball has its own brand of lingo. And every spring you'd show up and everybody asked you, there were five things that they were interested in. Did you have a nice winter? I mean, in what other business do people talk about seasons? I mean, having a nice day is bad enough, but did you have a nice winter? Did you drive down? Gee, your weight looks good. Where are you staying? And probably the worst of all, how's the family? I mean, how's the family? Those were some of the most boring things to even bring up. Not if someone says, how's your wife, Ann, and how's Kathy and Kelly, your children? That's a lot different. But anyway, one spring I had some cards made up, and I answered all these questions and just handed out cards. And I abhor cliches. I really do. And I'm glad that I do, because it served me well in my broadcasting business.
Anyone who's broadcast live knows that there are times when, because it's your turn to say something, you can say the stupidest thing, the most embarrassing thing that you ever imagined. Has that happened to you? That it's been like your turn, you open your mouth, and something all wrong and very embarrassing comes out.
Oh, it's happened to everybody who is broadcast. As an example, during the 1986 season, a season in which the New York Mets were obviously very successful, there was a lot to talk about, and a very exciting season for the people in New York City. Of course, the Mets went on to win the World Series. Well, I remember back in the middle of June, there was a ground ball hit to Howard Johnson, the third baseman for the Mets, and the ball took a bad hop, and it was Ralph Kiner, my colleague, was doing the play-by-play. I was doing the analyst work at the time. Ball took a bad hop, and it hit Howard in the shoulder, and it kind of rolled down his arm into his glove. And he made a nice recovery and threw the runner out at first base by a step. So now our director, Bill Webb, comes right on the shot, and I said, this mental image of a mother holding her child flew into my mind, and I thought, well, I'll use it. And a lot of times you just fire out with the first thing that comes to your mind. A lot of these things aren't planned. And I said, sometimes, and I'm going over the replay, and I said, sometimes an infielder, because of the hop, has to handle the hop like a mother would handle her child. Now watch how Howard smothers this ball against his body. And the word smothers came out, and I said, I can't believe I said that. And I looked at Ralph, and Ralph looked at me as if to say, get yourself out of this one, pal. And Ralph said, I think you meant cradle. I said, cradle, that's the word. So certainly you really... you really do get in trouble there. But the one thing I do remember was from an old broadcast partner of mine who said that he had good advice as an ex-athlete when he broke in. His name was Richie Ashburn. And Richie said that somebody told him once that if you don't have anything to say, don't say it. And on television, that's very, very important. Silence is useful and as important as something fruitfully chosen.
When you're in the booth and you're announcing a game, what do you have with you so that you can be up to date on everybody who's up at bat or whatever?
The stats are, you are furnished with a myriad of stats. And believe me, you could talk nothing but nonstop stats during a baseball game. But people can't digest all of the numbers that are thrown at them. That's why I think it would behoove broadcasters to be more human in their approach. And I think that, generally speaking, most broadcasters are changing, that stats aren't as important as they once were. I mean, it's just not a game of numbers. It's the human side of it. I remember during the 1985 World Series, I was very, very nervous. It was my first World Series that I'd ever done. And I was working with Al Michaels and Jim Palmer. And after the first game, the next day we had the production meeting. And I naturally, wanting to improve our broadcast like everybody did, I asked our producer, who's now the senior vice president at ABC, Dennis Lewin. I asked Dennis, I said, is there anything I can do to improve this broadcast? He said, everything last night was great. It was just wonderful. Try to humanize it a little bit more. And I had never really been told the fact to humanize it, but I think that's what people want to know. They want to know how a ball player is going through the same problems that they might be going through if they were ball players at that time. And you can't tell them that by telling them one number after the other. People can't digest things like that. They want to hear the human side of it, and that's what, especially since that time and since I'd heard it, that I'd tried to do.
You've been announcing Mets games for the past few years. Mm-hmm. Do you start really rooting for the team, and when they were in the series and when the series last year, do you become a real fan as well as a journalist and announcer?
Well, I am a human being. I think I had the opportunity to root for the ball club when they played during the World Series last year because I was a fan. And as a fan, I have the right to root. But as a broadcaster, in my opinion, I don't have the right to root. I think it's perfectly all right to be to imply that you are hired by the club. And after all, the Mets do pay my salary. I'm not foolish enough to bite the hand that feeds me. However, people don't want to hear that, especially a town like New York, especially on a cable station that goes through to every corner of the country. People don't want to hear we and us and they. There's a different theory about this. Some guys do it. Some very successful announcers do it. They are homers, they are rooters, and they're very, very good announcers. It's just my philosophy that I think that you are, if you take this as an overall attitude toward broadcasting, the rooter syndrome, that you're not going to give the public enough objective analysis, and eventually you're at some point in time you're not going to be able to put yourself in a situation where you have to tell the truth, and you got to tell the truth on the air.
How carried away do you like to get if someone's hitting a home run? You know, you're following the ball, the going, gone.
Yeah. I don't really have any set calls. I was never trained in the communications business, and I try to be as natural as I can. I think being natural is the thing. And if I choose to get excited, I'm relatively excitable by nature anyway. So if I choose to get excited on a home run call, I don't think about it. I just go ahead and do it.
You know a lot of the players' secrets because you've played with some of them. Secret weaknesses. Yeah. I don't mean their private lives,
yes,
but like
right.
little secret weaknesses that only other players would really know about, or locker room talk that only other players would really have access to. Now you're a sportscaster, and you have to decide how much of that to inform your audience about. What are the ethics of that? Someone comes up to bat, and you know a lot about them.
Well, often teams will not allow broadcasters or the media in the training rooms for obvious reasons. If a runner, a guy like Vince Coleman of the St. Louis Cardinals, for instance, has a minor leg pull or a hamstring pull and would not be able to run as well, and you reported that, well, obviously the other team could hear it. That's why announcers and the media are not allowed in the training room. I, from my playing days, some of the guys are still around that I played against. I just say it on the air. If they have a weakness or a strength, and for the most part, most of these players know the weaknesses and strengths of the hitters. It's just execution. The hitter, the pitcher, I mean, hitters are not dumb and neither are pitchers. Most of these things are known. If a guy's a low ball hitter, it's pretty easy to find out that he's a low ball hitter. But if you keep throwing him high fastball, then he adjusts. He's got to do that if he expects to play Major League Baseball.
Being a sportscaster is really the perfect job to have when you retire from baseball. You're still in the game. You're just
right?
Commenting on it instead of playing it. The fans are still there. It's still a baseball life. Do you feel sorry, though, for colleagues of yours who were less successful in making that transition out of baseball into a second career? It's not the easiest thing to do.
No, it's not. I think I don't feel sorry for sympathy is not one of my favorite words. Naturally, I think some are given more opportunity, and the ones in baseball who are given the most opportunity are those with marquee value. I didn't have a lot of marquee value, but I felt like the marquee value that I didn't have, I overcame with hard work. And that's what athletes have to realize they have to do. It's a completely different business on the other side of the microphone, and too many guys think that all they have to do is show up and do a job. It's just not that easy.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I've loved it.
My guest has been sportscaster and former Major League catcher Tim McCarver. He's written a memoir titled Oh Baby, I Love It. This is Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with author Nicholas Prophet. His novel Gardens of Stone has just been made into a movie by Francis Ford Coppola, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with playwright John Guare. His award-winning play, The House of Blue Leaves, is about a middle-aged zookeeper who really wants to be a Hollywood songwriter. Also today, singer Ian Whitcomb looks back at Tin Pan Alley. Critic Ken Tucker says you have a second chance to see Manhunter, just released on home video. And we'll get the news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. My guest is playwright John Guare. He wrote the musical adaptation of The Two Gentlemen of Verona and the screenplay for the film Atlantic City. His award-winning play, The House of Blue Leaves, will be broadcast on the next edition of Public Television's American Playhouse. It's about Artie Shaughnessy, a middle-aged zookeeper whose real ambition is to write songs for Hollywood films. But the farthest he's gotten is the neighborhood cocktail lounge.
Hi, my name's Artie Shaughnessy, and I'm going to sing you songs I wrote.
Back together again. Back together again.
Thank you.
Since we split up, the skies we lit up looked all bit up like Fido chewed 'em. But back together again. You can say you knew me when we were together. Now we're apart. Thunder and lightning's back in my heart, and that's.
Artie isn't the only one lusting after fame. Just about everyone in this play wants to be a celebrity or at least rub elbows with the stars. Blue Leaves is set in Queens, New York, where playwright Guare grew up. It's just across the river from Manhattan. The House of Blue Leaves won the New York Drama Critics Circle Award for Best American Play when it first opened in 1971. It was revived in 1986 by the producers who had just taken over the Lincoln Center Theater, which had been dark for a long time. The revival won 4 Tony Awards. I asked John Guare if he expected the revival to be such a success.
If one had a crystal ball in the theater, if one could tell the future in the theater, then you'd say, well, of course I knew. I mean, I don't know how you're going to rush. You just say, I just hope I come out of this not too bloodied. I mean, if you come out of a production wanting to go on to the next production, that's been successful. If you get enough energy to want to write another play, that's already a successful production.
Since you'd written it several years ago, did you feel a little bit detached from its success at the revival?
Oh, no, no. I mean, I'll tell you why. It's because one of the things that was terrific about the success of it, since it was being done at Lincoln Center, and so one had the feeling that it was not just a commercial production that was independent unto itself. This was about a theater was beginning, and a lot was riding on the new management of the Lincoln Center Theater. So the success of Blue Leaves made me doubly happy, because it wasn't just being part of a success of my play, it was how many other things were going to be made possible by the success of Blue Leaves. And I felt really thrilled to be part of that.
So you're a hero?
No, I wasn't. I think they were heroic to want to do the play, to risk that much on a play. They always say, where are the new playwrights? Where are the new directors? They're all over the place. What there is a real paucity of is the American producer. Where is the new producer who has that faith in American work and an imaginative way to put it on?
The main character in Blue Leaves is a zookeeper who really wants to make it in Hollywood as a songwriter. But this guy lives in Queens, he's middle-aged, and he keeps describing himself as too old to be a young talent. Did you ever feel that way yourself?
Yes, I did, because I don't think you ever are older than you are at age 28. Because you're still, you know, you've been that long out of school, but still the future seems to be an impossible place to enter into. And I think probably when I wrote the play when I wrote that first act at age 26, 27, 28, in that period, I was never older, no one is ever older than they are at that time.
The main character in your play is a songwriter. We're supposed to be marveling at what a minor talent this guy is, and the songs are supposed to be not very good. However, did you write these did you give them your best shot as really good
Absolutely.
Songs?
But the funny thing is that one of the first investors in the show in about 1969 or 1970 was Frank Lesser, who heard about the show and heard the songs. And he said, if this was like 10 years ago, he said, I'd sign you. They're almost good enough. I can't put my finger on it. Well, I thought these were classics that I had written. Oh, I was thrilled. No, but these were written straight on.
Well, how do you feel as an actually accomplished songwriter to have included songs in your play that you actually meant to be good, and now you're including them as examples of bad songs?
But I don't think they're bad songs. I think what's comical is that the guy is basing his entire life on this, on these songs. The play only works when we see the actor's belief in the songs, and that's what we have to follow. If the actor makes fun of the songs, then there's nothing to play. The audience has contempt for the people in the play.
Everyone in your play wants to be famous or to at least be friends with the famous. And all the Queens residents in your play are very frustrated that they're trapped in an apartment building in one of the boroughs of New York. Did you grow up surrounded by that kind of frustration?
Well, of course. I mean, but Queens is a very special part of New York City. It had no identity. It was literally a country place. I mean, Brooklyn was a city, but Queens was this place where you moved to on your way up the ladder, just a place where you passed through. And the play seemed to be about people, including my family, not just my family, but people who just got, this was as far as you were going to get. You weren't going to move out. And the tormenting thing about Queens is that you look up and it's 14 minutes from Times Square. I mean, you stand on the street, you go up to your roof and you can see the Empire State Building. You see there is Manhattan. There it is that close. I always dreamed about people who would come to, arrive in New York on a bus at midnight with a cardboard suitcase and say, I'll lick you yet, Broadway, to have that first time that you see New York. What happens when you grow up and you're already there? You're where you want to be. How do you earn your way when it's all so tantalizingly close?
But I think even though you're just 14 minutes away from the heart of Manhattan when you're living in Queens, that people who are actually in Manhattan and people in the Manhattan Theater don't look at Queens as part of Manhattan. It's like living in exile when you live in one of the boroughs.
Well, exile is, that's as good a word as any, if you want to be there. That's the maddening thing, is that the energy is so close. You don't have that luxury of saying, oh, God, here I am stuck in. I'm in North Dakota. I'm in Oregon. I want to get to where it's happening. What do you do when you are where it's happening, where everybody's trying to get to? That seems to be the paradox and the nightmare.
Did the frustration that you witnessed of wanting to get out, wanting to make it, make you swear that when you grow up you'd be a successful playwright?
No. I didn't have to. It wasn't frustration of wanting to get out. It was the possibility of saying, I knew very early that I just wanted to work in the theater. And I was very lucky that I had parents who said they couldn't think of anything better to do. So it was not a sense of entrapment. I always felt completely freed. I always felt that I knew I had my out. When I was 11, I had three plays. I wrote three plays. And Newsday, Long Island's leading newspaper, wrote a story on them. And there I saw after my name, there was a comment, John Guare, 11-year-old playwright. And for my 12th birthday, I was given a typewriter because of this, because of these three plays I wrote that were done out at Atlantic, at Atlantic Beach, by Long Beach. And I felt that I had an identity. And so it wasn't ever that sense of frustration, what am I going to do? I knew from age 7 what I was going to do.
You have a great ear for dialect, for the way people speak. And I wonder if you think that growing up in a neighborhood in Queens helped that along at all.
You just listen to the way the people around you speak. I mean, everybody grows up in their own musical setting. I mean, whether you're in Oregon, whether you're in Florida, whether you're in Ohio, I mean, there is a music to every bit of speech, wherever you are right now. You just have to learn to listen to that rhythm of where you are. And it's not just as simple as that.
Great. John Guare, thank you very much.
Really? Okay.
Playwright John Guare spoke to us from the NPR studios in New York. His play, The House of Blue Leaves, will be featured on the next edition of American Playhouse on public television. John Mahoney stars as frustrated songwriter Artie Shaughnessy.
Here's a song I wrote at work today. I hope you like it as much as I do. Where is the devil in Evelyn? What's he doing in Angela's eyes? Evelyn is heavenly. Angela's in a devil's disguise. I know about the sin in Cynthia and the hell in Helen of Troy. But where is the devil in Evelyn? What's he doing in Angela's eyes? Oh boy, doing in Angela's eyes.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Well, the Iran-Contra hearings are adjourned until Wednesday.
They are indeed. And our top story today is on the Florida Memorial Service for the 37 sailors who lost their lives on the USS Stark. We also talked to an expert on radar technology. It turns out that there's a kind of catch-22 with even the most advanced radar. Using it allows you to pinpoint the enemy, but like turning on a flashlight in the dark, it makes you a better target as well.
Who will you be speaking with?
Well, I spoke with John Vanderzee, author of the book Golden Gate, on a subject dear to my heart because I'm from San Francisco, the building of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Okay, thank you, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ken Tucker is wearing two hats on Fresh Air. He's our rock critic, and he also reviews movies just released on home video. One advantage of video cassettes is that they give you a chance to see films that were overlooked when they were first released in the theaters. Ken says a good example of this is Manhunter, a 1986 film directed by Michael Mann, who also created Miami Vice.
Ever since the success in the early 70s of movies like Dirty Harry and The French Connection, American audiences expect their thrillers to be nasty, brutish, and short, noisy, abrasive affairs. This is one big reason why Manhunter is so satisfying, such a pleasant shock. Based on the thick, tricky Thomas Harris novel called Red Dragon, Manhunter offers us the opportunity to watch a maverick FBI man track down an insane but brilliant serial killer. Unlike Dirty Harry, however, the Manhunter, played by Chicago theater veteran William Peterson, doesn't pull a booming cannon out of his pocket to solve crime. Instead, he does that rarest of all things in an action movie. He thinks. Early in the film, Peterson visits a jail cell to check in with a killer genius he's already put behind bars, hoping to catch the scent of his new target.
You want to know how he's choosing them, don't you?
I thought you might have some ideas.
Why should I tell you?
You get to see the file on this case. And there's another reason.
Pray tell.
Thought you might be curious to see if you're smarter than the person I'm looking for.
Then by implication, you think you're smarter than me since you caught me.
No. I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me, Will?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
The whole movie is like that, low-key and ironic. Director Michael Mann has done two previous features, the tough James Caan melodrama Thief and the interesting flop The Keep. You can check that out on cassette, too. Mann created this past season's cool cop show, Crime Story, but he's best known as the perpetrator of Miami Vice. And at the start of Manhunter, you might become alarmed at the warning signs of that TV show's tiresome trendiness. Every scene in the movie seems to be lit by cool green neon. The lowliest cop wears a chic designer suit. You keep looking at the bottom of the screen to see whether anyone's wearing socks underneath those soft loafers. But for the first time, Michael Mann has used his prodigious technique for something besides slickness. And finally, here's a brooding cop hero who has a family, a wife and son he actually seems to enjoy living with. Michael Mann has often been accused of being a cold fish director, but in this film, Mann uses this tendency to great effect. When was the last time you saw a slash-em-up whose high point was a calm, unsentimental chat between a father and son about the nature of evil? What a pleasure it is halfway through the movie to realize that you're totally caught up in the intricate twists and turns of a sturdily constructed plot. Where most thrillers these days force their actors to shout in order to trump up some urgency, Manhunter speaks in hushed, measured tones, and you find yourself on the edge of your seat, listening. Terse, troubling, and unashamedly emotional, Manhunter deserves to become a cult classic on video cassette. As for other recent releases, if you groove on Manhunter moodiness, check out They Drive by Night, the cassette debut of a 1940 film noir with Humphrey Bogart, George Raft, and the real tough guy, Ida Lupino. And if you like your law-breaking performed with deadpan dreariness, there's Down by Law, director Jim Jarmusch's follow-up to Stranger Than Paradise.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's what's coming up next time. On our next show, I'll speak with actor Werner Klemperer. You may remember him as Colonel Klink in the TV series Hogan's Heroes. He's now co-starring in a revival of the musical Cabaret. Like the original production, the revival stars Joel Grey. Jazz critic Francis Davis will review a reissue of a classic Dizzy Gillespie session, and TV critic David Bianculli will let us in on the 10 warning signs of bad TV. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.